is Monday, April 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence issues a warning to North Korea.
All options are on the table as we continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with the people of South Korea.
Turkish voters approve a referendum giving the president additional power. And we hear how country musicians Dan and Shay support animal rescue. It's all ahead. Vice President Mike Pence, on a 10-day four-nation Asia tour, visited the demilitarized zone Monday, separating the two Koreas, and reaffirmed U.S. support for South Korea to preserve their freedom and ensure the objective of a denuclearized Korean peninsula.
It is an objective not just shared by the United States and the people of South Korea, but by our allies across the globe. We are heartened by the support of allies across the Asian Pacific, including China, who will continue to advance this objective on the Korean Peninsula. And I'm here to express the resolve of the people of the United States and the President of the United States to achieve that objective through peaceable means, through negotiations, but all options are on the table as we continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with the people of South Korea for the denuclearization of this peninsula and for the long-term prosperity and freedom of the people of South Korea.
Pence said the period of strategic patience with Pyongyang is over. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster said on U.S. television Sunday, Washington is working with its allies and countries like China to develop a range of options designed to curb the North's missile and nuclear programs.
The president has made clear that he will not accept the United States and its allies and partners in the region being under threat from this hostile regime with nuclear weapons. And so we're working together with our allies and partners and with the Chinese leadership to develop a range of options.
However, he said the consensus is that the problem is coming to a head and it's time to consider all options short of a military response to resolve it peacefully. Pyongyang unsuccessfully attempted another missile launch Sunday. Korea Society Senior Director and Columbia University Professor Stephen Norper tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, while growing cooperation with China is significant, the big story is McMaster suggesting a military response is not likely anytime soon.
By playing down the military aspect, it at least signals that there will be a coordinated response, but as has been emphasized, it will probably be hard-hitting by way of sanctions and other financial measures. And as we see Secretary of State Tillerson heading up to the United Nations in the coming week, it will be one that is bent on coordinated international response and the step up in activity.
There are four broad categories of options that are being considered: economic sanctions, covert action, diplomatic negotiation, military force. What might be the best course?
Oh, I think it will most likely be a combination of harder-hitting economic measures. Already there have been significant sanctions put into place, but more attention will be placed on enforcement. There will probably be a further ratcheting as well as a further cutting off of North Korea from the international financial system. And we've seen the swift closures and others in recent weeks. And so that type of momentum will continue. Also, a real push for diplomatic activity, because I think the opinion of most analysts is that we need to get back to the negotiating table. And it seems that that will certainly be the emphasis that China will continue to push. But I think the expectation of the Americans will be to see China get North Korea back to the negotiating table.
We've had a decade of sanctions so far. It hasn't worked.
Well, we've had a decade of sanctions that have not been the most stringent. In fact, up until recently, the sanctions on Zimbabwe were generally regarded as more stringent than those on North Korea. And also there's the broader question of compliance, in particular China's noncompliance. So if the current sanctions, especially those put in place since United Nations Security Council Resolution 2270, which came into effect after the fourth nuclear test, then we'll have the look for people to try to be patient, let them take further effect. And so part of the thing I would suggest is that we just haven't seen those sanctions, the more strident sanctions, in place for very long. And that may take 2 or 3 years to see real results.
Meanwhile, South Korea's acting president, after meeting the U.S. vice president, said Monday they agreed to the early deployment of the U.S. missile defense system, THAAD, which has been controversial in South Korea as it awaits presidential election on May 9th. President Trump says Chinese President Xi Jinping is doing what he can to help deal with North Korea. But as Pyongyang continues to fire missiles and seemingly ignore the rest of the world, how effective can China be? And will the United States have to resort to some type of military action? VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman examines the possibilities with VOA's Jim Stevenson as a U.S. naval carrier strike group positions itself near the Korean Peninsula.
Jim, I suspect that when Donald Trump took the oath of office, he anticipated a largely domestically focused agenda for his first few months in office when it came to repealing and replacing Obamacare, maybe getting started on infrastructure projects, reforming America's tax code. These were all things on his to-do list.
Right.
But here we are, roughly at the 100-day mark. Syria has very much been on his radar screen, and now North Korea is on his radar screen. And it is a reminder that Donald Trump is the leader of the United States now, and world events will come to his desk. And certainly with North Korea, this is a country that has been a problem for many administrations to deal with. And now it is Donald Trump's problem, in a sense. North Korea did have yet another missile test launch. It was a medium-range missile. It apparently exploded within seconds of being launched. But at the same time, at this parade, there were what appeared to be some sort of longer-range missiles that no one had seen before, and no one knows if they're real or if they're fake, if they're simply for show. I assume that they're not made out of cardboard. But whether they actually contain any machinery inside that would propel this thing out well into the Pacific, whether something like this could reach U.S. territory, no one really knows. It's just a reminder that this is a country that is very difficult to keep tabs on. It's a very secretive country. And this is a problem that is going that I suspect the Trump administration is going to be dealing with, as previous administrations did, for quite some time.
As you mentioned, Donald Trump was squarely focused on domestic issues during his campaign. He did mention China a lot, and then when it finally came to meeting Xi Jinping in Mar-a-Lago, the talk was expected to be mostly on trade, a little bit on North Korea, getting China to perhaps exert its influence on its neighbor to contain North Korea a bit, and then off go the missiles to Syria while the two presidents are sitting there looking at chocolate cake.
Indeed. And here's the thing. I mean, if you think back to the campaign last year, I don't think Donald Trump had one kind word to say about China or about its government or about its trade practices during the entire campaign period. And one of his most clear and repeated promises would be that from day one, he would name China a currency manipulator, meaning that China has long been believed to artificially keep its currency at a low value, which makes its exports more attractive on the world market and makes imports into China more expensive. And so the thinking is that this gives China an unfair trade advantage. And there are many in the U.S. Congress who believe that China is a currency manipulator and who believe that the United States, along with other countries, have lost entire industries to China based in part on this currency manipulation. Donald Trump sent out a tweet just a short while ago saying, well, of course we're not going to name China a currency manipulator while China is being helpful in trying to resolve the North Korean crisis. So it would seem that while there's a lot of saber rattling going on, and the Trump administration is very clear that all options are on the table, including presumably a military option, but for now, they are hoping that China will take the lead in exerting some kind of pressure on Pyongyang to rein its military programs in. Other administrations have also encouraged China to do the very same thing. But it would seem that, at least for now, Donald Trump is willing to use this currency manipulation as some sort of leverage or some sort of trump card, you might say, in order to hopefully get China's fuller participation in some kind of effort to influence North Korea.
As everyone looks for a diplomatic solution to this, we always turn to VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman for the very latest and what is happening here in Washington and around the world. Thank you, Michael.
Always a pleasure.
And Michael Bowman was speaking to VOA's Jim Stevenson. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's going on?
Wow, busy times on the Korean Peninsula,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to turn our attention away from that to a story that's really occupying social media in the United States, at least, and also involving it, as we see with news stories. Now, this is a tragic story, really hard to understand. On Sunday in Cleveland, 34-year-old Steve Stevens was recording himself on Facebook. He was recording a video. He says into the camera, he says, "That guy right there," as he's passing by some random person, he says, "I'm going to go shoot him." And sure enough, he gets out of the car. This is all taped. He gets out of the car. He walks up to the guy. He says a few words to him. This would be 74-year-old Robert Goodwin Sr. And then takes a gun out and shoots him dead. Now, he wasn't on Facebook Live, as some of the news reports had been saying. He taped this, but he did post it to Facebook, and now there is a four-state manhunt. People across the region are, I think, in shock, but just really kind of reeling from, you know, what could this possibly be about, and just the horror of it being on Facebook. But here's the element that loops social media back in, which is that many people across Ohio and now in Michigan and Indiana are taking to social media saying, "I just saw Steve Stevens here. I just saw his car there," that kind of thing. And it has police officers in the region chasing their tails. I mean, these are just a couple tweets. "We just saw him at the corner of Wilson and Caves in Chesterland, Ohio. No, he's actually in Solon. That's another town in Ohio. We see him there. No, my sister says she just saw him in Chesterland," which is a neighboring suburb of Cleveland. And what's happening is the police, every time they see one of these things, they have to go check it out.
Yeah.
And so far, it's all been for naught. They've all been, I won't say wild goose chases, but it's all panned out to nothing. And police are now taking to social media to say, you know, be careful, watch what you do, do not approach this man if you think you see him. But just call us. Don't take to social media. Don't start panicking, everybody. Just call us if you think you see where this guy is, and we'll deal with it.
Yeah, very, very disturbing story.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Doug. That is social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. An Egyptian court has acquitted an Egyptian-American woman and seven others after nearly 3 years of detention on human trafficking charges. A German Navy ship took a group of migrants to the Italian island of Sicily, and former South Korean President Park Geun-hye is indicted on bribery charges. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study concerning string theory was recently released by mechanical engineers at the University of California, Berkeley. Before you think this concerns a quantum or particle physics hypothesis, this study concerns shoestrings, specifically why our shoelaces manage to keep getting untied. They found out that the failure of a shoelace knot takes place in just a few seconds and is set off by a series of complex force reactions that act like an invisible hand. These forces loosen the knot and then tug on the free ends of the laces until they become undone. While tying shoelaces as tightly as possible will still result in the knot becoming untied eventually, doing so at least will give you more time before you have to stop and retie your shoes compared to laces tied loosely. I give my shoelaces a double bow to keep them secure. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the country music duo Dan and Shay tour to support their latest album. Turkey's president is claiming victory in the closely fought referendum on changing his nation to a powerful executive presidency from a parliamentary system. But opposition parties are challenging the results, citing voting irregularities. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan claimed a narrow victory in the referendum to extend his presidential powers with 51-49% of the vote. To cheering supporters here in Istanbul, Erdogan said victory promises to usher in a new era of prosperity. He says, thank God we have achieved a difficult thing and we are realizing the most important governance reform in our history with the courtesy of our nation. Erdogan struck a defiant tone, promising he would immediately take steps to restore the death penalty and, if necessary, hold another referendum. In a statement to reporters, the president said, now it's time to focus on the goals of the nation. But a similarly defiant stance came from Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, leader of the main opposition, Republican People's Party, who said his party is contesting the result. The High Election Board has thrown a dark shadow on the people's decision. They have caused a referendum's legitimacy to be questioned, he said. The CHP claims the High Election Board, which administered the voting, broke election rules by allowing 1.5 million votes that did not have the required official stamp, a measure aimed to counter vote stuffing. The party is also challenging 1 million votes that were invalidated. The winning margin in the referendum was only 1.25 million votes. The way the votes were tabulated is also being challenged by political parties opposing the referendum. Protesters have been gathering outside the election board headquarters in Ankara. While protests have broken out across Istanbul, with people banging pots and claiming the vote was stolen. Similar protests are being reported on social media in other cities. Mainstream media have so far ignored the demonstrations. The referendum grants sweeping powers to the presidency to appoint ministers and rule by decree, along with greater control over the judiciary. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Country musicians Dan and Shay are touring to support their album Obsessed, and their song I Pray For You is featured in the movie The Shack. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, how the duo deals with life on the road, and they support a cause they both care about, animal rescue.
I pray you love like your mama, you forgive just like she does. Pinochet met at a party in Nashville and started writing songs together the next day. Their 2013 single, 19 You and Me, was a breakout hit, reaching number 7 on the U.S. country charts. Their new single, I Pray for You, is featured in the soundtrack to the movie The Shack, starring Octavia Spencer. Dan Smyer says the song holds special meaning for his partner Shay Mooney after the birth of his first child in January with his fiancée Hannah Billingsley.
The timing of it couldn't have been better. The video and the song came out, I think, like 2 days apart from when Shay had his kids. So it's a special song, and it's one of those ones that we get emotional on stage singing, and I think it's going to be a big part in our career.
The duo is currently touring in support of their second album, Obsessed. Shay Mooney says being away from his new family is tough, but his fiance does most of the work at this stage anyway.
You have a kid and you're gone completely and you feel helpless. But honestly, in these first few months as a dad, you're kind of helpless anyway, because the mom, and she's like doing everything, you know, nursing and all these things. And sometimes I'm at the house and I'm like, I don't even know. I have nothing. I don't know what to do. I can't help. I don't know how to take care of this kid. But no, it's been so much fun, you know, being able to learn that. No one can tell you how that's going to go until you actually have a kid. But it's been like the greatest adventure that I've ever been on.
Dan and Shay's second single from their sophomore album, How Not To, is currently 13th on the Billboard Country Airplay charts. The duo's success allows them to help with an animal rescue shelter in Nashville. Dan Smyer says using their fame and their newfound wealth to help animals is something they believe in deeply.
And thank you to David Byrd for that piece about the group, Dan and Shay. That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Uganda should take stock of the progress it has made in creating a healthier population. According to the recently released Uganda Demographic Health Survey, there are some clear and positive trends. More women delivering babies in health facilities, substantial reductions in infant and under 5 mortality rates, and an increased percentage of households with at least one insecticide-treated bed net to combat malaria. But while these statistics are encouraging, they mask a troublesome reality. The health of most Ugandans remains poor, with children especially at risk. There are many reasons to explain this situation, but most boil down to the fact that the country's healthcare system is under-resourced, poorly managed, and unable to meet the demands of a growing population. The evidence is clear. In developing countries, a government's investment in the health and well-being of its citizens is key to generating prosperity and progress. President Museveni pledged in the 2001 Abuja Declaration and reaffirmed in 2013 to dedicate 15% of the national budget to health. Today, that number stands at just 7%. Moreover, the government of Uganda's proposed budget for the next fiscal year recommends nearly a one-third cut for the Ministry of Health, plus reductions in other health investments. More must be done to meet the healthcare needs of Uganda's citizens, especially its youngest and most vulnerable. There are still at least 2.4 million Ugandan children under 5 who are chronically malnourished. Only 2/3 of people living with HIV are receiving life-saving antiretroviral therapy, and there are 8.5 million cases of malaria annually. The proposed reductions to the country's health budget will put these lives in greater jeopardy. The United States has done its part to help build a healthier Uganda. Last year alone, we invested nearly $500 million, more than 1 trillion Ugandan shillings, in the country's health sector to control the HIV/AIDS epidemic, combat tuberculosis, improve maternal and child health, and control malaria. This work is saving lives and improving the health of millions of Ugandans, and we are proud to contribute to such efforts. The U.S. government calls upon the government of Uganda to increase investment in the health of its people so Uganda can reach its full economic potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.